Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who assesses the importance of the recent federal appeals court ruling, which found that NSA Dragnet collection of Americans' phone metadata is illegal. Amanda Starbuck, Climate and Energy Program Director with the Rainforest Action Network, who talks about her group's successful campaign pressuring Bank of America to end its financing of coal production. And Russ Choma of the Center for Responsive Politics, who discusses the significant findings of his group's new report titled The Political 1% of the 1%, Mega Donors Fuel Rising Cost of Elections in 2014. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Greenpeace India faces an imminent shutdown of its operations due to pressure from the administration of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, which has frozen the organization's bank accounts. The move is part of a broader crackdown by Modi's Ministry of Home Affairs against non-governmental organizations that receive foreign funds. Greenpeace India, which employs 340 people, has raised 75% of its funds from thousands of supporters in South Asia. The group has campaigned vigorously against coal pollution and rampant development. Greenpeace campaigner Priya Pillai, who was prevented from traveling to London by the Modi government, says the freezing of Greenpeace bank accounts sends a chilling message that will go out to the rest of Indian civil society and the voiceless people they represent. Modi's Home Affairs Office has also targeted the Ford Foundation due to their funding of the Sabrang Trust and Citizens for Justice and Peace, who were critical of Modi's role during the 2002 riots in the Indian state of Gujarat that left over 1,000 Indians, mostly Muslims, dead. Last fall, Loic Rajabov left the Central Asian nation of Tajikistan, north of Afghanistan, to move to Moscow to look for construction work. A few months later, he phoned relatives back in Tajikistan saying that they were moving to Syria to join ISIS. According to the Guardian newspaper, Rajabov was given $30,000 to move to the war-torn city of Aleppo, Syria. The family was given a four-room apartment with a television and refrigerator. Rajabov is not an Islamist fighter, but rather inspects cars for alcohol and cigarettes, which are banned by the so-called Islamic State. Up to 4,000 Central Asian migrants now live in Syria, often recruited by Chechen gangs. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov claims ISIS is recruiting allies in Afghanistan and sending them to create havoc in Tajikistan. Russia is now sending new security assistance to the Tajik-Afghan border. Ahmad Ibrahim, editor of the newspaper Paik, based near the Afghan border, observed, "In Afghanistan, there are groups of ISIS fighters. There are Tajiks, there are Uzbeks. They are being trained to attack their own country. Central Asians who have migrated to Moscow face a tough life finding work and are susceptible to appeals from ISIS to move to Syria." The city of Los Angeles is suing banking giant Wells Fargo, alleging that quotas for cross-selling financial products forced employees to open unauthorized accounts, harming the credit of banking customers. Los Angeles City Attorney Mike Furr claims Wells Fargo pushed bank employees to engage in unfair, unlawful, and fraudulent conduct through a corporate culture of never-ending high-pressure sales quotas. In the process, bank employees misused customer confidential information and failed to close unauthorized accounts. The scheme, alleges L.A. City Attorney Furr, allowed Wells Fargo to create a virtual fee-generating machine. Staffers feared punishment for missing sales quotas and begged friends and family members to open ghost accounts and forge signatures on paperwork. Wells Fargo has blamed the abuses, first exposed by the Los Angeles Times in late 2013, on a few rogue employees. But the investigation by the city of Los Angeles found only token enforcement efforts by California's largest bank. The lawsuit claims Wells Fargo failed to inform customers about the account breaches, refused to refund bank fees, and provided no remedies to compensate injured bank customers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill. We'll be right back.
In a landmark ruling on May 7th, the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan found that the National Security Agency's bulk collection of Americans' phone metadata is illegal. The court said that the NSA program, first revealed by former government contractor Edward Snowden in 2013, was not authorized by Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, signed into law in the weeks following the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Circuit Judge Gerard Lynch wrote in his ruling for a three-judge panel that such expansive development of government repositories of formerly private records would be an unprecedented contraction of the privacy expectations of all Americans. While the court did not rule on the surveillance program's constitutionality, it noted that Section 215 of the Patriot Act, that both the Bush and Obama administrations said permitted the NSA spy operations, will expire on June 1st. The Federal Appeals Court ruling, coinciding with the coming expiration of Section 215, could provide advocates of repealing or reforming that measure needed momentum. GOP Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Intelligence Committee Chair Richard Burr both support a bill to extend Section 215 and other parts of the Patriot Act through 2020. But over in the House of Representatives, the Judiciary Committee voted 25-2 to adopt the USA Freedom Act that would end the NSA bulk collection of telephone data. The bill is expected to pass the full House with the support of President Obama. But NSA whistleblowers and civil liberties advocates support another bill, the Surveillance State Repeal Act, that would completely repeal the 2001 Patriot Act that authorizes many other surveillance programs targeting the Internet and financial transactions. Your reporter spoke with Shahid Buttar, executive director with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who assesses the importance of the recent federal appeals court ruling on NSA dragnet surveillance and the effort now underway in Congress to repeal or reform these government spy programs.
The significance of Thursday's decision is that for the first time, several district courts have attempted to do this before. This is the first time an appellate court, this is the Second Circuit, the Second Circuit has ruled that the surveillance program, the first of the many surveillance programs revealed by Edward Snowden, that it's illegal. Not that it's unconstitutional, which is to say they didn't decide that Congress can't authorize it. They just decide that Congress hasn't, and that the Patriot Act did not suffice to justify or provide a legal basis for mass surveillance. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how it interfaces with the congressional debate. That section is set to expire in June, and there are several members of Congress, including the Senate Majority Leader and the chair of the Senate Intel Committee, who would seek to, they have a bill that would reauthorize those provisions without any reforms, basically trying to extend an illegal program.
Shahid, as you look at the prospects for reform or outright repeal of Section 215 of the Patriot Act, maybe you can run down some of the options here. One of the legislative bills that addresses the Patriot Act, Section 215, is the USA Freedom Act, which is a reform bill. Then there's the Surveillance State Repeal Act, which goes a lot further and is favored by a lot of groups such as yours. Maybe you can talk about those two options.
Let me contextualize the full range. The Majority Leader and the Senate Intel Committee's bill, which would basically extend the expiring provisions without any reforms. So you could describe that as, you know, legislators not showing up for work, you know, accepting getting lied to by executive officials, accepting executive secrecy, writing blank checks despite documented abuses, and abdicating their constitutional role. The Surveillance State Repeal Act is the other end of the spectrum. That's the bill that would remove the Patriot Act entirely from the books, as well as a 2008 law that made it much worse, called, there were amendments to a previous law called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Those are the twin statutory pillars on which the NSA dragnet rests. And the Surveillance State Repeal Act would, as it's described appropriately, would repeal both of them. You might describe it as shifting the burden of proof to require the agencies to justify the expansion of their surveillance powers from a constitutional baseline instead of a baseline contrived by a decade of executive lies to Congress. And this also should not be controversial because back in 2001, when the Patriot Act was first enacted, it was adopted by Congress before the congressional investigation into the 9/11 attacks had been completed. And by the time that had been completed, what Congress found was that data collection and the agency's collection powers were not the reason, were not the intelligence failures that enabled the attacks. The intelligence failures that enabled the attacks were failures of data analysis and sharing. And the Patriot Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Amendments did very little to address the real problem. What they did was fix a non-problem, that is data collection, and create very real problems in the specter of unreviewed, secret, potentially abused surveillance. And we know many cases where, for instance, NSA agents have used the government's powerful surveillance tools to spy on their former lovers and ex-wives. And the idea of mass surveillance facilitating stalking and domestic violence is disturbing, to say the least. If you strip away the legal mumbo-jumbo, is the question of whether or not the government can examine you when you haven't done anything wrong. Whether or not the government can examine you even if no one thinks you've done anything wrong. What mass surveillance through its various mechanisms, whether it's surveillance drones, whether it's the NSA dragnet, whether it's the phone metadata program that Congress is considering in Section 215, what they all have in common is ambient collection, untargeted collection, surveillance of everyone all the time, randomly. And that's the problem that is, quite frankly, so constitutionally offensive that I think it's fair to say that the members of Congress who have voted half a dozen times now to first enact the Patriot Act and then reauthorize it, every one of them has been derelict in their oath of office in defending the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That was Shahid Buttar, Executive Director with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. For more information on the campaign to repeal or reform Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Bank of America has joined several other financial institutions in the U.S. that have recently made policy decisions to stop financing coal production. The bank announced its new policy at its annual shareholders meeting on May 6th in Charlotte, North Carolina, where it's headquartered. Institutions such as banks and universities are rethinking their ties to coal companies based on several factors. One issue is that coal has become a risky investment due to environmental regulations and increasing concern that coal assets could be stranded, i.e. left in the ground, because of its major contribution to global warming. Research data has revealed that the atmosphere held more than 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide for the entire month of March 2015, whereas 350 parts per million is considered the safe upper limit before massive climate disruption becomes inevitable. The mining and burning of coal also creates pollution that causes serious and even deadly human health impacts. Bank of America's policy change comes after a four-year campaign waged by the Rainforest Action Network and other groups, and is the strongest corporate policy of its kind to date. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Amanda Starbuck, Climate and Energy Program Director with the Rainforest Action Network, who talks about her group's successful campaign and what comes next.
The market is not looking good for coal at the moment. There's a number of reasons behind that. Here in the U.S., we've seen new regulations and better enforcement of existing regulations. So there are a lot more costs associated with being involved with coal, as companies that burn coal are having to limit the emissions, both local air pollutants and climate emissions. And companies that are involved with coal mining and disposal of coal ash, one of the byproducts from the coal industry, are being faced with the liabilities of the pollution to the local environment and the local communities that causes. So all of those extra costs make coal much less attractive, not to mention that we are seeing a big decline in coal power here in the U.S. as we start to transition to cleaner energy forms.
PNC Bank recently made a commitment to move away from mountaintop removal coal. What about other banks?
Yeah, so we've seen a number of very high-profile moves by major banks in the last few months. So earlier in April, PNC Bank announced that they are going to be ending their financing of mountaintop removal companies, and that came after a lot of pressure, especially from the Earthquake Action Team in Pennsylvania. And then we saw Barclays Bank, who are one of the biggest European banks, say that they too were going to stop financing mountaintop removal. And that's huge because only a year ago, they were one of the biggest financial backers of the practice. But Bank of America's policy goes even further. They're the first major bank to make a global commitment to reduce their exposure to coal mining wherever it occurs around the world. And for a bank like Bank of America, who has really significant overseas operations, that's significant and really represents a sea change. We'd love to see other financial institutions follow this.
Before this recent announcement, how did the Bank of America stack up to other banks regarding its investments in coal? I've heard it referred to as Bank of Coal.
So when we launched our campaign targeting Bank of America in 2011, our research at the time, by looking at industry league tables, our research told us that Bank of America was putting more money into coal in the U.S. than any other bank. And that was significant. That was why we chose to target the bank, because we knew that if Bank of America could move, that would make a major sign to the industry.
So what's the nitty-gritty in the bank's decision? What is it actually going to do?
What we understand about the bank's commitment is that they are going to be reducing their overall exposure to coal mine every year, and they've already started enforcing this. This isn't something they're announcing for the future. They've actually been doing this for at least the past year, and their financial exposure to coal mining has dropped by some 20 to 30% over the last 12 to 18 months. And what they're saying is that that trend is going to continue. So it's not an overnight exit from the sector, but it's a commitment to get out and by continuing to decrease year on year.
Amanda Starbuck, Rainforest Action Network and other groups led a very energetic campaign to get the Bank of America to get out of the coal business, including a lot of civil disobedience, especially at the bank's headquarters in Charlotte, North Carolina. Do you think, because of the financial considerations, the bank would have reached this change in policy on its own, or do you think it was directly the result of the pressure on it?
That's a great question. You know, I think that banks take a lot of factors into consideration every time they decide who they're going to lend money to, whether that's to a huge multinational coal mining company or even if it's to a person like me who might be looking for a mortgage. So there's always lots of factors. But the fact that Bank of America have chosen to make a public commitment, put out a statement, put out a publicly available policy and commit themselves to the future, that's not a simple decision that's just reflecting current financial markets. They're actually putting it down in the suite of environmental policies and saying this is the direction that we want to take, because they're linking it to their commitment to the climate. So while there may have been many factors influencing the decision, and this decision might be an easier one for a bank to take in 2015 than perhaps it was a few years ago, I think that the environmental reasons absolutely play into it. And also, all the pressure that they face, this has been a huge issue for the bank. Tens of thousands of people have raised this issue with them in their hometown of Charlotte, but people have also traveled from some of the regions most affected by coal mining, such as Appalachia and the Powder River Basin, to come and speak directly to the bank and say, this is the impact that your financing is having on our homes. Last year at the shareholder meeting, there were people who even traveled from Colombia and from India to come and take the message to the bank about the impact that their finance was having in their communities through coal mining finance. So the bank has also gained a lot of reputational credit for making a move like this.
So what's your next target?
We're going to continue to be keeping an eye on all the major banks, and not just the U.S. banks, but European banks and Chinese banks as well, and urging them to follow this example of Bank of America or to do even better. You know, if we're going to stabilize the climate, and the latest report from International Energy Agency says that we really need to take drastic action in the next 5 years to avoid runaway climate change, that means we need to leave fossil fuels in the ground. And not just coal. We also need to be thinking about oil, and we need to be thinking about gas. So while this is a really significant step, and we're very happy about it, we know that we've still got a very big job ahead of us.
That was Amanda Starbuck, Climate and Energy Program Director with the Rainforest Action Network. Learn more about groups engaged in organizing campaigns to rein in climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The U.S. 2014 midterm election set a record as the most expensive campaign in the country's history, where the wealthiest donors contributed 29% of all fundraising that political committees disclosed to the Federal Election Commission. The 2014 election also set a record for the lowest voter turnout in 72 years, where only 36.3% of eligible voters cast ballots across the country. Only the 1942 election, during the dark early days of World War II, had a lower participation rate at 33.9%. A new report titled The Political 1% of the 1%, Mega Donors Fuel Rising Cost of Elections in 2014, is a joint analysis of the Center for Responsive Politics and the Sunlight Foundation. The report provides ammunition to critics of the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United and 2014 McCutcheon rulings that opened up the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable campaign contributions from the nation's super-rich and giant corporations. The Political 1% of the 1% report found that the 31,976 top donors combined accounted for more than $1 out of every $4 raised by PACs, super PACs, parties, and candidates in the 2014 election cycle. Republican committees and conservative groups that support them raised $553 million from elite donors, more than the $505 million that Democratic and liberal political groups received. Your reporter spoke with Russ Choma, Money and Politics reporter with the Center for Responsive Politics and co-editor of the Political 1% of the 1% report. Here he summarizes the significant findings of his election analysis, which many observers view as evidence of a severe threat to U.S. democracy.
The reason that we decided to do it is we often get the question, you know, how much does the 1% give? And we always tell people, you're thinking too broadly. Most Americans never give money to a political campaign or a candidate. We figure less than 0.2% ever give more than $200 in a cycle, and something like 0.04% give more than $2,600 in the last cycle. So we wanted to get a sense of who the top donors were, because we get this question so much. And there was a very good report that was put out by the Sunlight Foundation in 2012 that used this methodology that we chose to bring up again, which was, you know, there's between 310 and 320 million Americans. So let's look at the 1% of the 1% of that. So basically the top 31,000 or so political donors. And we looked at them for each of the last three cycles, and we tried to see how much money they gave, who they gave their money to, who these people are. And the thing that we found was that in the 2014 elections, the cycle that just finished, these 31,000-odd donors gave $1.18 billion. The total election donors, all donors, gave about $4 billion. And so $1.18 billion came from just the top 31,000 people. And that's more than it's ever been. And it's the election cost more than ever before. And this sort of elite set of donors were responsible for a bigger chunk of the cost of the election.
Now, link, if you would, the findings in this report to the Supreme Court's decisions in both the Citizens United case as well as the McCutcheon cases, which really opened the floodgates of unlimited, in many cases, anonymous donations to political campaigns.
Sure. Elections have been getting expensive for quite some time. Every election that we've got data on has been more expensive than the one before. So that trend isn't new. But the Citizens United decision, which basically allowed unlimited donations to a new type of political organization, the super PAC, and it allowed corporate money as well. But really, we've seen a lot of individuals, wealthy individuals, taking advantage of the unlimited donations. And it also allowed some anonymous money. So it made it easier to give. You know, there were people who could always find a way to give. There were people who always gave an extraordinary amount, but it really made it easier for people to give unbelievable amounts, unprecedented amounts. And one of the things we saw, for example, was the 2014 election was, like all elections, more expensive than the one before. We compared it to the 2010 midterms because that was the sort of the closest analogy. So it was more expensive than the 2010 midterms. But the interesting thing that we noticed was that there were actually fewer donors than there were before. And in this report, we sort of explore that because these top donors, this 1% of the 1%, are paying a bigger share than ever before. So they need fewer people to make up the cost. And so the cost is going up, but the people who are paying it, the number of people who are paying it is declining. And it's because of Citizens United, in large part, because they can make these unlimited donations. You know, a candidate doesn't have to go to tens of thousands of small donors trying to get donations of $5, $10, or $50. You know, they can just hope that there's a super PAC out there that can go to one donor who can write a check for $500,000, $1 million, $2 million, $5 million. The biggest donor in 2014 gave $72 million, and the biggest donor in 2012 gave $93 million. You know, that really takes the importance of the small donors and really diminishes it.
Russ, there are a growing number of people in this country who believe that our U.S. political system is severely broken, serving the interests of the very wealthy few and not the majority of U.S. citizens.
And I think that was evidenced by the fact that during the 2014 elections, we saw the lowest voter turnout in some 72 years. So I'm not sure we can make the correlation right there, but a lot of people are not very happy with participating in a system where these billionaires appear to be calling the shots. I wondered if you would comment on that, and also some of the possible remedies for this, including what many groups are advocating, which is a constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision and moving towards a public financing system.
So, yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think that when you look at public opinion polls, most Americans do not, regardless of their political stripe, do not like the role that money plays in politics. Both sides feel like special interests and money have too much say. So the question is, what do we do about it, or is anything going to be done about it? You know, the Supreme Court is probably not going to change its makeup anytime soon. They've had opportunities to revisit the issue, and they've chosen not to. In fact, they've had additional decisions, like the McCutcheon decision that you referenced earlier, that further loosen restrictions. And so it seems like you've got to have Congress do something, and Congress can make a constitutional amendment. But this fall, the constitutional amendment made it to the floor of the Senate, and it got the majority. The Democrats controlled the majority, and it got the majority, but it failed on party line votes. It failed to get the 60 votes it needed to pass the filibuster. So every Democrat voted yes, and every Republican voted no, and it didn't go anywhere. And you know, the Republicans now control both houses of the Senate, and doesn't seem like a constitutional amendment is going to go anywhere anytime soon with that. And so I think that unless something happens that gets enough people angry, that gets both sides willing to work on this, even a constitutional amendment seems unlikely. Sort of the good news, bad news situation is that when we talk to people who work in this field, when we talk to lawyers who represent some of these outside groups, they tell us that they're scared, because they feel like they're walking through a minefield, that there's a big, big scandal that might break at any moment, and they're afraid that they're going to get caught up in it. So, you know, every day that goes by that the scandal doesn't break is another day, you know, sort of exponentially greater chances of it happening. And at that point, that's when you might actually get enough people mobilized to have some sort of reform. But, you know, for the time being, it's an issue that everyone talks about. And when you poll them, everyone says they're concerned about it. But when they go to the polls, they rarely make it a priority when they vote for a candidate. You know, there's economic concerns, there's foreign relations concerns, there's taxes, there's budget, all these sorts of things. It's something that bothers everyone but doesn't seem to make it to the top of anyone's priority list.
That was Russ Choma, Money and Politics reporter with the Center for Responsive Politics and co-editor of the Political 1% of the 1% Report. Find a link to the report and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.